the war in Iraq can and will be used to justify the outlawing of strike action.
We can be scared every 6 months or 2 months or whatever is necessary to keep us saying, here, take more rights away. To me, it looks like a scare tactic.
The way to deal with the threat of bioterrorism, in my view, is not to vaccinate everybody, because you can never vaccinate against enough pathogens.
We call for all states that are either known or suspected of having nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction, including the United States, to accept inspections of their own facilities on the same terms.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, December 13th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The White House held a press conference today announcing that U.S. military personnel and emergency recruiters would be required to take the smallpox vaccine. Exposing the general population to the smallpox vaccine sets up a scenario where millions can inadvertently become infected with the virus, according to bioterrorism expert Dr. Merrill Nass of Freeport, Maine. In an interview today, Nass advises that Israel has had success with a less virulent strain of smallpox vaccine and that the U.S. should explore the possibility of using Israel's formula if the administration feels a need to vaccinate against smallpox.
My understanding is that the military personnel will be required and that the health care workers and first responders will be given voluntary vaccinations. I personally don't think it's a good idea to treat the military differently than civilians. And I also believe that, in fact, it is unlawful to mandate smallpox vaccinations for the military at this time, because the available vaccine stockpile of Dryvax has been expired for several decades and legally cannot be licensed after expiration. There is no existing supplement to its license which allows it to come back into useful form after an expiration. And we're looking at least 30 years and perhaps up to 50 years of expiration. I've been calling the FDA on a daily basis for the last 2 weeks to discuss this issue, and although I've spoken with several people there, they haven't been willing to commit themselves one way or the other, even when I've pointed out that the Food and Drug Act, CFR 610.53, specifically says that this vaccine had a 24-month expiration.
So if this is an expired vaccine, what are the risks of having that used to inoculate people?
The reason I'm emphasizing the expired part is because if it's not legally licensed, it can only be used in humans under an investigational new drug license, and that requires informed consent. So you can't force people to take it if it's unlicensed, even when they're in the military, legally. Now, that doesn't mean that someone wouldn't try, because that has been done on many occasions in the military.
Mm-hmm.
Service members have been given many unlicensed vaccines without informed consent. And in this case, because this particular vaccine is potentially so dangerous, I don't think the military should have the right to mandate it for soldiers.
So what are some of the ones that they've been forced to take in?
First of all, anthrax, and again, that was an issue of vaccine that had expired, hadn't been redated properly, the plant hadn't been inspected properly, there were all sorts of problems. There was an existing investigational new drug for the vaccine, and yet service members have been forced to take that, over 500,000 of them, with many developing chronic illnesses as a result. Same thing happened, of course, in the Gulf, where they were forced to take it, and many became ill with similar illnesses. Other service members have been given malaria vaccines, hepatitis C vaccines, and only later discovered that there was no licensed product for that type of vaccine.
Well, let's just say, for example, that the vaccine itself is, in spite of the fact that the license expired, over 30 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the original vaccine was developed over 200 years ago, I believe.
Yes.
Let's just say it was still a viable vaccine. What are the risks involved
yes.
in taking
it
smallpox?
It is viable. Okay. It works for naturally occurring strains of smallpox, and it makes people sick in the process. It's a live vaccine, so you're giving people a virus, and what you're hoping is that that virus remains confined to one small spot on their arm, but that the illness that you're causing does not overwhelm the person you're trying to inoculate. And, of course, in most cases, that works very well. But, unfortunately, a fairly significant minority, which Dr. Anthony Fauci has estimated as 50 million Americans, there are pre-existing immune disorders, HIV positivity, organ recipients, some severe diabetics.
Pregnant women?
Pregnant women, people on cancer chemotherapy, and people with a variety of skin diseases, which leave open wounds, which allow this virus to get more of a toehold to cause a more systemic and severe illness. So if you're one of these people,
mm-hmm.
and this could be people with severe cases of acne or eczema, or if you get the vaccine and you are in fairly close contact with such people, you can spread the vaccine to them.
And so by getting vaccinated, you're actually being exposed to the virus.
Yes.
And so people can find themselves getting sick or ill,
yes.
and perhaps not knowing why?
Well, they will be told why.
No, I mean other people that aren't aware. If you said
yes,
that this can sort
that's
of
right. Yes.
spread
if
without unwittingly yes.
catches this virus, they won't know why.
The vaccine site leaves sores that contain
yes.
live virus. And,
that's absolutely
and,
correct.
And if touched, it can spread to any other part of the body.
But it can also spread through the air.
To other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an airborne virus.
Yes,
can be. And so, well, you know, we talked about the risk population. There's always a risk when you're talking about introducing vaccines to large populations of people, and not everybody is going to respond in the same way.
Right.
So aside from the ones that might be at risk because of the open sore, are there other people that should not be exposed to this vaccine at all?
Well, there was an interesting article today in which a number of doctors who know about this issue have said that infants and children should not be vaccinated, that only adults should be vaccinated because the serious reactions occurred at a much higher rate in children, and that these vaccines could unmask an unknown immune deficiency in children.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the outbreak in New York City in 1947, when several million people were vaccinated in a couple of weeks, two infants died who had not been vaccinated, but who caught this virus from people who had. And so that, again, raises the possibility that in some cases, virus becomes more virulent after it travels through humans or animals. So you may wind up with a more virulent vaccine strain after it starts spreading from person to person.
This is a deadly virus often or occasionally?
Well, you know, this virus doesn't even exist in nature anymore. We think it came from cowpox. Some people think horsepox. But it's not around. So people do not get this virus normally. It only comes out of vaccine bottles.
So if it were to suddenly appear in the United States, one would...
Would it spread? Now, that's an interesting question. Would people become ill? I don't think we know the answer, because when this was used before, almost everybody was vaccinated. So there was only a small population who were susceptible to this inadvertent spread,
mm-hmm.
whereas now half the population is susceptible. So we don't know how it will spread.
If it does suddenly appear in the U.S., can we assume that it's not by accident that it was used as a biological weapon, as an attack?
You're talking about smallpox.
Yes.
Now this is vaccinia, which is the not smallpox, but a related virus. Were smallpox to appear, I'm afraid we would have to assume that it was a deliberate use of biological warfare, because there is no smallpox. Smallpox was wiped out from the earth in 1976.
Okay, and so the upside of all this, of course, is if there is a biological attack involving smallpox, people with the vaccine will be protected, correct?
We hope they'll be protected. They would be protected from the naturally occurring forms, garden variety smallpox, that we used to see in this country and elsewhere. But there is the possibility that one can harden or strengthen a smallpox virus using several different means that I don't want to discuss, and make it immune to vaccine protection. And that is a serious problem that people are very concerned about.
So in summation, Dr. Nass, the upside of using a smallpox vaccination and the downside?
The upside is if we gave smallpox vaccinations to most people in this country, we would have pretty good herd immunity, which means the likelihood of smallpox spreading from person to person were a non-hardened version of smallpox used would be very low. If most of this country were vaccinated, probably nobody would use smallpox.
They might
use something else that people weren't vaccinated for.
Oh, I see.
You see?
You mean terrorists, would-be terrorists.
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, the problem is that all the countries that have developed biological warfare programs researched a large number of agents, and that includes the United States, Japan, Soviet Union, Great Britain, China, and other nations. That's one problem. Another thing to realize is the politics of smallpox. Right now, very few people in the world are immunized. You know, those of us who got vaccine when we were young have probably some residual immunity, and depends on the strain of smallpox whether that's going to help us out or not. But almost all the people who were born in the last 30 years don't have immunity, any immunity. So what that means is were somebody to spread smallpox widely, it's going to not remain contained in the United States. It's going to go around the world, and it will affect the poorer countries of the world much more severely than it will affect us. And it will have a devastating economic impact on the world economy. So who wants that? So I think the point is to not put your enemies in such a position where they have nothing left but to use smallpox and say, okay, we don't care anymore. The good news is people would have some immunity to smallpox, and unless it was a hardened smallpox they faced, they would be immune. That's the upside. The downside is we don't know how many people will be blinded, develop brain damage, die. We just don't know how many, because we don't even know how many people are HIV positive in this country. We don't have a number for how many people are taking steroids routinely, which is another contraindication. So we don't know how many people really have eczema. So we don't know how many people will be hurt. I think that it sends a bad message that the way to deal with the threat of bioterrorism, in my view, is not to vaccinate everybody, because you can never vaccinate against enough pathogens. The Israelis just vaccinated 15,000 people. They say they haven't had a high rate of severe reactions because the virus that they are using for their vaccine is less virulent than the old virus we have. So maybe we should really be looking at the Israeli virus, if it's so much better.
You mean the vaccine?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And grow some of that.
Dr. Merrill Nass is a biological terrorist expert with the Federation of American Scientists. In an historic agreement the European Union announced at a summit in Copenhagen today, it will add 10 new members: Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, and the Mediterranean islands of Cyprus and Malta will all join the European Union over the next 2 years. But one key country was left off the list, and as Khalid C. Mohad reports from Istanbul, the EU's decision is likely to drive Turkey closer to the Bush administration's position for war on Iraq.
If the militaries that ruled Turkey for more than 7 years have progressively withdrawn from domestic politics, they still seem to rule the foreign affairs. The first visit of U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz to a high-ranking officer right after the Turkish elections in November show the Turkish military plans to continue to cooperate with the U.S. military, whatever the nature of the new government and the opinion of its electorate. A recent poll showed 82% of the Turkish electorate opposed the war on Iraq. Selçuk is a 40-year-old teacher. He was one of the tens of thousands who turned out for a demonstration in Istanbul 2 weeks ago. He voted for the new Islamist government run by Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
All of the people must be against the war, I mean.
What about the American base in Turkey?
You know that American army is in Turkey for a long time. Nearly after the Second World War, American army is in Turkey every time. And they're using Turkey for the Middle East, for the Middle East. Against the Middle East.
And what do you think about that?
Yankee go home.
Selçuk was one of the few Islamists to attend the rally. Most of the people who came to protest came from left or extreme left organizations. And yet, Islamists make up a key part of the anti-war coalition in Turkey. Faris Kaya is not involved in politics, but he is a religious Muslim and holds a leadership position in one of the many Sufi brotherhoods, Muslim congregations known for their tolerance and wisdom. When asked about what message he would want to broadcast to the American people, he said,
"They should stop Bush, you see. They should stop Bush and to create problem. He is the much more troublemaker. He is much more troublemaker than Saddam Hussein, okay? He's opposing now. They don't support Saddam Hussein, but they do not support his way of dealing with him as well. Because what will happen now, a lot of poor and needy people, elder people, children will die more in Iraq."
Cemal Hoshak is leader of another Sufi congregation whose network through its newspaper, TV, banks, schools and unions have contributed to a renewal of political Islam in Turkey. He opposes the war on Iraq but understands why the government is poised to help the Bush administration.
"Unfortunately, AKP, who control the power in Ankara, they will accept the US policy. Why? Just shortly I can say, if you are in debt of more than $100 million for IMF, you have to do something. You are imposed to do something. It's an unfortunate position. They have to accept. No.
If you had a political responsibility, would you accept yourself to follow Americans?
Yeah, it's very easy to say yes or not. I don't think so, I would accept."
Islam Shilik is sitting in a taxi office across the street from the Islamic TV station. He watches one of Turkey's two religious channels. He says they are the only channels he can watch comfortably with his family without being offended by what he calls erotic content. He voted for the victorious AKP party and opposes the war on Iraq, but he says he won't be that angry if the government follow the US on this war. He says that while the AKP has expressed sympathy and support for the Iraqi people, it has never opposed a war on the country. Çelik notes that on the campaign trail, Erdogan told reporters if he were elected, he would follow United Nations decisions on Iraq. Çelik says that he hopes Saddam Hussein does the same in order to avoid the war. Indeed, over the last 3 years, the AKP has changed from an ideological Muslim party to a mainstream government party. So by the time it reached power earlier this year, the AKP had already forsaken most of its radical roots, making the climate even more favorable to President Bush is the European Union refusal to allow Turkey to join the Federation before 2005. Rebuffed by the Europe, Turkey's new Islamist government is thrown into the warm embrace of the United States. For Pacifica Peace Watch, I'm Khaled Sidmohan in Istanbul.
An unnamed senior Iraqi official is quoted in Newsday today as saying the 12,000-page document Baghdad handed over to the UN last weekend contains a list of U.S. companies that sold materials and chemicals to Iraq that may have been used for developing weapons of mass destruction. The materials were reportedly sold during the 1980s before the relationship between Washington and Baghdad went sour. Kelly Motz is editor of Iraq Watch, part of the Wisconsin Project, a website that's been tracking this data for years. Motz believes despite the government's desire to keep the information secret, Iraq Watch has been highly publicizing its list.
It's been well established that the U.S. sold them a lot, and as Western suppliers in general, the Germans, the Brits, the U.S., we were all involved before the Gulf War in selling the Iraqis what they needed to make chemical weapons, and also a lot of nuclear-capable equipment was left at the end of 98.
The U.S. Department of Commerce, in fact, licensed more than $1.5 billion worth of sensitive U.S. exports to Iraq from 1985 to 1990. Most were dual-use items capable of making nuclear weapons or long-range missiles if diverted from claimed civilian purposes. So that in and of itself, that information, I think some people might find startling. What is your reaction to that?
Well, that's actually a report that the Wisconsin Project released back in June of 91. We did a study of Commerce Department records, and we really did license a lot. We knew where some of these items were going. For example, we sent millions of dollars of sensitive equipment to missile sites, to known nuclear sites, and especially we gave them a lot of computer help, which would be important for missile testing or nuclear weapon design.
And so who are some of the firms that are listed as selling chemicals and or materials to Baghdad to develop these weapons of mass destruction?
Well, computers came from all over. We had IBM computers, Hewlett-Packard. There's a whole laundry list of names that helped with the nuclear weapons program.
Did they understand that that's what these were going towards?
I think in many cases they did, yes. Many of these pieces of equipment were dual use, so you can say that you didn't know, but you know, I mean, when you're sending computers to known nuclear research sites, it's hard to make the argument that you don't know what you're doing.
So other than computers, what else were they selling to the Iraqis?
Well, equipment that would help build missiles, machine tools that went into the Scud missile program, radar components.
Were these dual use as well?
Well, radar components are not particularly dual use. They're military.
What about Scud materials for Scud missiles?
Well, machine tools are definitely dual use. You mean you can use a machine tool to build anything civilian at the same time you need high-end machine tools to do the precision work required for missiles or nuclear work.
Mm-hmm. And those were sold as well?
They were sold, but they are dual use as well. We sold things such as rocket casings, sold just about everything you can name, oscilloscopes.
What's oscilloscope used for?
It's used to, in nuclear weapon testing, it picks up the very brief signals that would come out of a nuclear weapon test, especially measurement equipment.
So there's no dual use for that?
Well, you could measure other signals that would be very brief besides nuclear. You use them, for example, in maintaining radar, but also for, you know, missile guidance systems or for nuclear weapons tests. There are multiple uses. All of this equipment was dual use.
Well, does that let them off the hook, in your opinion?
No, I don't think so. I think it was really guilty knowledge. They knew many of the sites they were selling to were involved in Iraq's missile and nuclear programs, and in some cases the chemical programs. And I think it was a political decision. We were supporting Iraq at the time.
Kelly Motz is editor of Iraq Watch. Joseph Wilson is the last U.S. official to meet with President Saddam Hussein yesterday at a press briefing in Washington, sponsored by the Center for International Policy and Fenton Communication. Wilson gave his perspectives and opinions on the current administration's policy towards Iraq.
Regime change is a policy objective that the United States has had in place for a number of years with respect to any number of regimes around the world. Just to note a few, Libya and Cuba, right off the top of my head. One other one that comes to mind, that in the run-up to the recent elections in Germany, that this administration would have welcomed a regime change in Germany. And for those who follow domestic politics, I can assure you from coming from California that this administration has long had in place a regime change policy towards poor Gray Davis out there. Let me also say that, of course, the best book on this that's been written, and I will just make a couple of more comments, is Ken Pollack's book, in which he makes the argument that a regime change and an invasion of Iraq is the only option because it is the least bad of all the other options. But one of the things he says is that coercive containment would not work because we would be unable to summon the political will to put it back into play or to sustain it. Now, I think that's been belied by the facts of the president having gone to the United Nations and having said to the United Nations, we're either going to do this together or I'm going to do it alone. And I think that the president can continue to go ahead, go back to the United Nations and get that support to do pretty much what he wants in the disarmament realm. And then secondly, I think the one thing that strikes me about his book is that he mentions in it that that Desert Fox, which was a four-day campaign that we ran in 1998 against sites of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, was far more effective at roiling the political waters in Baghdad than we thought at the time. Now, both of those lead me to the conclusion, unlike Ken, that invasion is not, and regime change is not the only and not even the best option that we have at our disposal as we take a look at this. And that, in fact, coercive containment, as he calls it, or muscular disarmament, as I've called it for the past several years, is a viable alternative which might actually yield the desired results, national security.
As the former U.S. foreign ambassador to Iraq, Joseph Wilson knows President Bush Sr. personally. Wilson is also close to the current Bush administration. Speaking at the press briefing, Wilson described the attitudes towards Iraq of Bush's inner circle.
A year ago, I spent a lot of time talking to people who I fought the Gulf War with, that team, the people around the president's father, about this phenomenon of a fringe part of the policy debate, i.e. regime change as a rationale for military intervention, suddenly moving to occupy the center of the debate. And I was told then not to worry, that they just weren't going to get there. It was going to fizzle out. In June or July, some people that I have a lot of respect for got nervous themselves about this, some of the same people I've been talking to for 6 months, and started writing their op-eds. I wrote a piece that did not get published but got circulated broadly within the administration and up on the Hill, and particularly in Democratic circles, at the time of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee meetings, and became accepted by those who have since been arguing that we need to have clarity of objective, and the objective needs to be in our national security interests, most effectively in the last couple of months by Al Gore. But also before that, if you go back and you take a look at what Joe Biden was saying during the course of the hearings and after the hearings. I also wrote a piece that got published in the San Jose Mercury News in early October before the UN debate took place. And I got a call from one of my friends from the old Bush administration. I'd sent it actually to three people as a courtesy. And I got a call from one of them saying, I'm going to take this over and give it to the president. I got a letter from another one a couple of days later saying, I agree with almost everything. I refrain from commenting on it because I don't want to place the president in any sort of difficulty. And the third one, I just got a letter from him about a week ago saying, looks like the administration is doing pretty much what you said they ought to do. The article, you should be able to find it on San Jose Mercury News of October 13th, but it lays out essentially a thesis where disarmament takes center stage over regime change. This week's argument is that we have to go to war because the president's prestige is at stake. Now, I find that to be a sign that they are real concerned that perhaps they're not winning the argument. So I conclude from all of that that the president understands the risks involved in this particular decision, and that he is sincere when he says that war is the last and not the first option. I also conclude from just my reading of the president, who I don't know personally, that he understands that in order to succeed in your objectives without military action, you have to be prepared and credible to use military action if necessary. So I guess that's a long way of saying I think that the president is probably still keeping his options open. He has certainly made it apparent over the past several months that he doesn't mind tacking as necessary. He doesn't get so locked into a position that he's unable to move out of it. So what does that mean going forward? Who knows? If I were a journalist, I'd be trying to press the administration for definitions of terms like zero tolerance and forcible disarmament. I make the distinction between war, which I define as a ground invasion for the purposes of conquering the country, and military action in support of a disarmament objective. And military action in support of a disarmament objective can be done standing offshore, basically. You can do it with aircraft, and you can do it with TLAMs and cruise missiles. And that you can do any time during the year. You don't need that. The question always comes up, well, how much can the president mobilize all these forces, move them into place, and then demobilize them? Is there sort of a use it or lose it problem? I think that's a legitimate question to raise. I would make the argument that you can either bring them home and then redeploy them next year if you need to again. If, in fact, a muscular disarmament strategy is not working, if you need to further enhance that, you could do so. That the consequences of bringing some of them back or rotating them out are far less expensive and potentially far less dangerous to our troops than just moving them in to Baghdad, either because you're afraid that there's going to be a loss of prestige for the president or because you just don't want to keep them on the border some during the hot summer.
Former U.S. Foreign Ambassador to Iraq, Joseph Wilson. Thanks to Reem Kadhuda, Peace Watch producer for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, for that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.